Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Each month, the Windows in Time lecture series features well-known writers and historians that bring alive the people, values, and events that shape the history and heritage of Southern Oregon. The lecture series is jointly sponsored by the Southern Oregon Historical Society and Jackson County Library Services. Programs are presented in Medford on the first Wednesday each month, both in person and online. They are presented again in Ashland on the second Wednesday of each month in person. We'll post this information on our website at jeffexchange.org. Joining me in the studio is my next guest, Laura Ahern. Laura is president of the McKee Bridge Historical Society. She's a researcher, writer, and curator of the virtual museum at mckeebridge.org. Laura is also a Windows in Time lunchtime lecturer. Welcome, Laura.
Good morning, Mike.
So your lecture is titled, The Blue Ledge, From Scandals to Superfund. Tell me about your upcoming talk.
Oh, I'm happy to do that. Much has been written about the Blue Ledge mine, but I was lucky enough to be given the opportunity to digitize and review a vast collection of original mine documents, as well as original photographs of the heyday of the mine. They were collected by the founder of our historical society, Evelyn Byrne Williams. So combined with that and today's digitized databases and robust search engines, I've been able to fact check the lore that had been built up about the mine and learn a lot more about the intriguing characters that were behind its development from around the turn of the century to the 1930s. So it's the story of how we got the mess that later became the Superfund site, although I do have some updates about the Superfund process as well.
Okay, well, scandals that are Superfund are scandals and a Superfund.
Yes.
Take me back to how the Blue Ledge mine was discovered, and where is it?
Okay, the Blue Ledge, let's talk about the mining district. The term Blue Ledge actually has many different meanings. It's a distinct geological part of the Siskiyou Mountains. It was designated as a mining district that's just over the state line into California, largely centered on the Joe Creek Canyon. Then it became a discrete mine. It was bought by a New York company that called itself Blue Ledge. They built a company town called Blue Ledge. So the story, to go back to its discovery, when gold was first discovered here in the Jacksonville area in 1851-52, some of the prospectors just spilled over and kept on and on looking for gold. By the late 1890s, three prospectors looking for gold up Joe Creek found this blue stuff instead. A number of other claimants came in and filled that district with their mining claims. But when you find copper as an independent gold prospector, you're kind of stuck. Unlike gold, which as a gold prospector, you can bring your mining pick in your pan in with your mule and you find some nuggets, you carry them home in your pockets. With copper ore, you need to move huge volumes of the ore to a smelter by train so it can be reduced, all of that copper value extracted into something that's saleable.
So there's a process to get the minerals out of the ore.
That's right. And to do it, you need a smelter, which we didn't have in this vicinity at all.
Okay, talk to me about a smelter.
Okay. Well, and the closest smelter was in Keswick, but it was right next to its own mine. And the Gilded Age capitalists and the business bigwigs who got into the development of the Blue Ledge didn't have the right connections there. Their connections were at Tacoma up in Washington, 457 miles away from this remote Blue Ledge. So their scheme, their insistence from pretty much day one was, we're going to get control of this mine, but then we're going to build a smelter up in what we now consider pristine areas of the Upper Applegate Valley. We'd have a big belching smelter, and a railroad right along the Applegate River from Jacksonville to the smelter.
Okay, so they were going to build all the processes, all the infrastructure that they needed to get this copper out of the ground and into some place where they could benefit from it.
But Mike, your question begs the way you phrased your question begs the question: who was the they? Who was going to do this?
Right.
So first, we had just mom and pop claimants, if you will, and a bunch of fancy people from Crescent City came up and bought up all those copper claims. They aggregated them, and they thought they'd sold them to a very famous mining magnate in Spokane named Patsy Clark.
You said they thought.
They thought, because, well, the way these deals work, they were called bonds, but they were like an option. But the person with the money, in this case Patsy Clark, would say, all right, I'm going to commit to spend, in his case it was $250,000, to develop the mine, and then I'll figure out if I really want to buy it. But Patsy Clark backed off. Maybe he saw that this place is so remote and rugged. How is he ever going to get meaningful quantities of ore out?
Right. So the railroad wasn't there.
Well, there was never a railroad, although cyclically over these decades, first it would be the New York mining magnate who steps in next, who will certainly build a smelter and a railroad. Then it might be the people of Jacksonville actually had a committee and collected money. They were going to buy up right away and give it to yet a different railroad company. At one point, the citizens of Medford passed a tax. They taxed themselves to build the railroad, to pay for it. So there were all these different...
So problem solved.
Oh, yeah. Well, until the court vacated the deal because it was riddled with fraud and misrepresentation.
Hold it 1 second. My guest is Laura Ahern. Laura is president of the McKee Bridge Historical Society. She's a researcher, writer, and curator of the virtual museum at mckeebridge.org. Laura is also a Windows in Time lunchtime lecturer. Her lecture is titled, The Blue Ledge, From Scandals to Superfund. Okay, we're having a little fun with all these scandals.
Well, I'd like to read a couple of newspaper articles that will give listeners, you know, a sense of the passion that the Rogue Valley business community felt for the Blue Ledge Mine.
Okay.
I have to say my thesis is this was not shared by the rural residents of Applegate Valley. But in 1904, when this New York mining magnate, Robert Safford Towne, steps in, this is what the Jacksonville Sentinel wrote. As the tunnels penetrate the ledges, the ore shows up in increasing richness and in bodies of immense quantities that will make possible the erection of great smelters like those that have made Butte and Anaconda famous. The building of these smelters is no longer a matter of the distant future, but of the present, and it is reasonable to expect that within the next 5 years, the solitude, now over the upper Applegate, will be broken by the ceaseless activity and bustle of a great mining camp. So we see these promotional schemes over and over, and they are presented and funded by notable men, a few from the Jackson County area, many from the outside, who have a phenomenal talent at going bankrupt, being sued for fraud or deceit. This is in the words of the U.S. Supreme Court. Some of these cases go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the promoters and the deal makers behind the Blue Ledge had that track record of insolvency and being held guilty of fraud, yet they kept working on it.
Wow, that sounds like some people we know. Oh, well, never mind. Go on.
Well, before my retirement and being able to delve into history, I was an environmental lawyer for 19 years with background in Superfund. So your listeners might be interested in understanding more what created the need for the Superfund site. It's because of each mine's going to be different, but abandoned mines commonly produce acid mine drainage. Mm. When the rocks are exposed to the elements and water, it creates this acidity that leaches the heavy metal out of the dirt and the rock. And here at the Blue Ledge, the mine was way at the top of a very steep canyon slope, overlooking the Joe Creek. The miners would go in, they'd drill, they'd dynamite, they would create what they called muck, waste rock. Then it was the job of the mucker to scoop all of that muck into a barrel or a cart, take it to the opening of the tunnel on this very, very steep slope and just tip it over the edge.
Just dump it into the river?
Well, it was probably 200 or 300 yards from the creek, but eventually over time through gravity and percolation, All of that acid mine drainage started to hit the creek. And when the Forest Service first started to identify the problems and do sampling in the creek up and downstream, they found it pretty healthy upstream and dead downstream with such high levels of metals. But that's the process that was most behind the Superfund problem, but also this lack of transportation. Sooner or later, the miners would actually find some valuable ore, but there was no place for it to go except what they called on the dump. So for decades, the ore would just be kind of stockpiled there, and it too, of course, would be percolating the acidity and heavy metals down into the stream.
So they were mining all this ore and they were putting it on the dump.
That's true, until December 1916, when finally it made any economic sense to try and bring just wagon loads of the ore down out of this remote canyon to the train here in Medford. And that's because of World War I. It created a huge spike in copper prices. And for the first time, you could justify,
now there's an
all
incentive.
That trouble. Yes.
Yes. Okay, so they have an incentive to get this ore or this copper down to the railroad. How did they do that? And what happened to the muck?
Okay. Well, the muck was just left there in the canyon until 2011 when the Forest Service got funding through the American Recovery Act and also some money from the ASARCO Trust that was set up to cover environmental liabilities of that Tacoma smelter. And they removed the muck, 66,000 tons of it.
Hold on. You went from 1916 to 2011?
That was pretty much the time of dormancy. There was a little blip in 1929 where Dr. J.F. Reddy, who was involved in this whole long story, he leased the mine and theoretically bought it 6 days before the great market crash. But he went up to, quote, rework the dump. But basically only from December of 1916 to January of 1921 was the mine working in an orderly fashion, if you will. Find some ore, send it to the smelter. And to go back and answer your question, originally what would happen is they'd just shovel it into a wagon drawn by a team of four horses and take it down the very steep, twisting wagon road up and over Dead Horse Hill on East Side Road.
I wonder why they call it that.
Yeah. Well, and ultimately in 1917, the county government built McKee Bridge to circumvent that one very dangerous stretch of the road. In the 1919 timeframe, they started to use Maxwell trucks, motor trucks they would call them. But the first 4 miles were so rugged, they still had to use horse-drawn teams to get the ore out of the canyon.
This is such an interesting story, and I know that there's more to it. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Well, I have more time next Wednesday.
Tell us when and where.
It'll be at the Medford Library Wednesday at noon. They do start promptly. If you'd rather view it by Zoom, go on the Jackson County Library Services website and you can sign up for a Zoom link. And we'll repeat the performance at the Ashland Library on February 12th at noon.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Mike.
My guest was Laura Ahern. Laura is president of the McKee Bridge Historical Society. She's a researcher, writer, and curator of the virtual museum at mckeebridge.org. Laura is also a Windows in Time lunchtime lecturer. Her current lecture is titled The Blue Ledge, From Scandals to Superfund. We'll post links to the lecture series on our website.